This is continuing coverage of United States versus Sean Diddy Combs from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
It's not often you hear a courtroom go completely silent, not the kind of silence where people are just listening, but the kind that hangs in the air like everyone's collectively holding their breath. That's what happened when Cassie Ventura, once known to most of the world as the polished pop star and Diddy's longtime girlfriend, began detailing what really went on behind the glittery public facade. What she described wasn't just a toxic relationship. It was a system of control so deeply rooted in coercion, humiliation, and fear that consent itself seemed like a foreign concept in her world. And it all started with what he called the freak-offs. Let's be clear. This wasn't your standard issue celebrity kink story. Cassie alleged that these freak-offs were orchestrated sex events, often involving male prostitutes, where she was expected, not asked, to perform, while Diddy watched, sometimes participated, and almost always recorded. Picture that. Not just the trauma of being forced into degrading sexual acts, but knowing that someone's filming it. Not as some private moment, but as a weapon. Cassie testified that these tapes weren't just personal keepsakes. She said Diddy kept them for leverage, implying that if she ever crossed him, they could become very, very public. That's not intimacy. That's blackmail, and it turned every coerced encounter into a form of psychological captivity. But it wasn't just the camera rolling that made those nights unbearable. Cassie told the court that Diddy frequently supplied her with MDMA, starting from the very first night they were together, when she was just 19 years old. She described being handed a blue dolphin pill, not really understanding what she was taking, and then suddenly being out of it, disconnected, watching herself from a distance. That became the norm. The drugs weren't about partying, they were about dissociation. A way to numb her while he pulled the strings. Every freak-off, every encounter was shrouded in that haze. She wasn't just high, she was chemically detached, too impaired to process or resist. From a legal standpoint, this isn't just tragic. It gets to the core of the prosecution's argument that these weren't consensual acts, but trafficking, orchestrated and sustained by pharmacological control. The sex tapes and the drugs set the scene, but what made it unbearable long-term wasn't just the events themselves, it was the environment Cassie says Diddy built around them, a world with no exits. According to her testimony, he managed her not just like a partner, but like property. He dictated who she saw, what she did, how she dressed, when she could leave the house, as her friends faded away. Her career slowed to a crawl. Everything orbiting her life had to clear through him. That's not just possessive, that's isolation. And the more she tried to pull away, the tighter the leash got. She described him as monitoring her movements and behavior like a paranoid CEO guarding trade secrets. Only the secrets were her thoughts, her decisions, her autonomy. And when she tried to exercise any of that autonomy, even briefly, things got dangerous fast. One of the most terrifying examples Cassie gave involved a brief relationship she had with rapper Kid Cudi. A relationship, mind you, that only happened after she and Diddy had broken up. But breakups apparently weren't something Diddy took lightly. Cassie testified that when he found out she was seeing Cudi, he didn't just get angry, he got vengeful. He told her flat out that Cudi's car would be blown up. That sounds cartoonishly dramatic, until it happened. Cudi's car really did explode in his driveway not long after that threat, and his spokesperson has confirmed it. Diddy hasn't been charged in connection with the explosion, but that doesn't make it any less disturbing. It's the kind of detail that transforms the whole story from one of private dysfunction into something much more calculated and dangerous. It wasn't about heartbreak. It was about dominance. At this point in her testimony, it became clear that Cassie wasn't just talking about a pattern of abuse. She was describing a machine designed to break down resistance, extract submission, and reinforce itself with money, power, and fear. The drugs made her docile. The tapes made her afraid to speak. The isolation made sure she had nowhere to turn. And the car bomb, well, that made it crystal clear what would happen if she tried to move on. This wasn't a relationship gone bad. It was a system engineered to keep her trapped. It's why prosecutors are treating this case not like a salacious celebrity scandal, but like a serious sex trafficking enterprise. And it's why, even as the trial continues, the weight of her words is still reverberating. What Cassie laid out was more than a story of survival. It was a map of control. From the moment the first pill hit her palm to the moment a car exploded in someone else's driveway, she said she was living in a world where every path out came with a threat. Every no became a negotiation, and every part of herself that she tried to keep private was gradually weaponized against her. And just when you think it couldn't get worse, when you think maybe the worst of it was the humiliation or the jealousy or the loss of control, that's when she starts talking about the physical violence, the rage, the moment it moved from psychological warfare to actual documented brutality. But that's where we go next, because when coercion fails and control starts to slip, what happens next can be even darker. You'd think after everything Cassie Ventura had already shared on the stand, drugging, coercion, threats, blackmail, that maybe the worst was already out there, that maybe we'd already hit the low point. But then came the hallway, a hotel, a surveillance camera, and an act of violence so brazen it didn't happen in the shadows. It happened in public, with witnesses just a floor away, with a kind of clarity that doesn't need interpretation, just video. The incident happened in 2016 in Beverly Hills. Cassie and Diddy had checked into a luxury hotel. On the surface, just another night in the world of celebrity excess. But behind that suite door, things had spiraled. Ventura told the court that Diddy had become enraged following a freak-off that didn't go the way he wanted. She tried to leave the room after he allegedly punched her in the face, but it didn't end there. According to her testimony, when she fled into the hallway barefoot and shaken, Diddy followed. Not to talk, not to de-escalate, but to throw two heavy glass vases at her, one after another, shattering them in the corridor. And this time, there was a camera. Surveillance footage captured it all. The hallway, the chase, the violence. The tape was played for the jury, and it reportedly showed Diddy chasing Ventura and kicking her on the ground, not metaphorically, literally. Footage that didn't just corroborate her words, it punctuated them. But the twist? That tape almost never saw the light of day. Ventura testified that Diddy paid the hotel $50,000 to buy the footage after the incident, effectively burying the evidence. He didn't deny this either. In 2024, long after it had resurfaced, Diddy issued a video statement saying he was disgusted by his own actions in that recording, and that he took full responsibility for what it showed. In a case built on testimony, implication, and corroboration, this video was the rare, undeniable thing, proof. And yet the question lingered. If something that violent was hidden for years, how much else stayed buried? Still, not all of the horror was captured on film. Some of it played out in ways so personal, so dehumanizing, that Cassie said she had to dissociate just to survive it. In court, she spoke in detail about the humiliation layered into the coerced sex acts, especially those orchestrated freak-offs. But it wasn't just the sex. It was the degradation. Ventura testified that Diddy would urinate on her during these events. Sometimes another man would do the same. Sometimes it would happen while she was being choked. She described one instance where she gagged on bodily fluids and couldn't breathe. She told the jury that it wasn't something she agreed to, it was something she endured, something that became routine. This wasn't about dominance in the bedroom, this was about psychological erasure, about turning a human being into an object. Ventura didn't mince words. She said she would mentally leave her body during these encounters, staring off and pretending she was somewhere else. Her only job, she said, was to keep going and not cry. Because crying made it worse. From a legal standpoint, it deepened the prosecution's narrative that This was never consensual, never safe, never voluntary. From a human standpoint, it laid bare just how far Cassie had been pushed beyond her boundaries. And if you thought that kind of degradation only happened in physical spaces, Ventura had more to say. One of the more unsettling revelations came when she testified about a medical scan she'd undergone. A routine MRI, something she pursued after experiencing episodes of memory loss. A deeply personal medical procedure, something that should have been confidential, but it wasn't. Ventura said she found out Diddy had somehow received her MRI results, not because she gave them to him, because he had access. The implication was clear. Even her efforts to check on her own mental health were being watched. She couldn't even try to understand what was happening to her brain without Diddy being in the loop, without him knowing, without him again holding that mirror of control to every part of her life. While this moment may not carry the same cinematic weight as a hotel hallway or a bomb threat, it landed in court with the same weight of violation. Not physical, but deeply invasive. But the moment that shut the room down, the one no one could breathe through, was the story of what happened in 2018. This was after everything, after the violence, after the surveillance, after she tried to leave. Cassie testified that Diddy showed up at her home uninvited. She had ended the relationship. She was trying to move on, but he came back. According to her account, it wasn't a reconciliation attempt. It wasn't a plea to talk things through. She told the court that Diddy forced his way in, pushed her down, and raped her on her own living room floor. Ventura described crying, saying no, begging him to stop. She said he didn't. She said his eyes looked blank. Black, she called them, as if she wasn't even there. Just a body to overpower. It was over fast, she said, but the damage was permanent. That was the moment she left him for good. And that is one of the central criminal charges in the federal case. This wasn't a crime of passion. It wasn't spontaneous. According to Ventura, this was the final act of a man who had already spent years eroding her sense of safety, identity, and control. It was the culmination. The closing chapter in a story that prosecutors say began with manipulation and ended with violence, there was no tape of that. No footage to roll in front of a jury, just her voice, her story, her words. And still, they landed like evidence. Because by the time she got to that point, the jury had already seen the hallway. They'd heard the threats. They'd watched a man kick a woman while she crawled across a hotel floor. They'd heard about the recordings, the drugs, the fear. And when Ventura said, "That's when I finally left," no one asked why it took so long. Because by then, we understood just how hard it was to get out.
In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you've taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.